I'm Christopher Lydon, putting the wonders of the World Cup on pause for just a moment to consider the South African Vishwas Satgar's questions about just what it is we're looking at but not seeing at maybe the most watched human happening of all time. This is Open Source from the Watson Institute at Brown University, a mostly American conversation with global attitude, we call it. This one is with a labor lawyer and left-wing activist from South Africa who has had reservations all along. Like the Beijing Olympics in summer 08, this World Cup is a coming-out party, sort of historic marker for Africa at the center of the maximum world television stage. Africa is the stage this time. But before the action resumes, Vishwas Satgar would like you and me to puzzle about who built this stage, on whose nickel, for whose benefit, at whose expense. Vishwas Satgar, I'm intrigued by these questions. What ideally should it mean to be having the World Cup in Africa this time?
I don't think we needed the World Cup to place South Africa back into the interstate system, into the sort of global community. I think that the democratic breakthrough that South Africa has experienced, the tremendous kind of shift to a post-apartheid democracy, I think is symbolic and important in itself, and has given the country a very important purchase, a very important currency in the context of world politics. I think the World Cup was not necessary to further augment that. South Africa is within the global imagination and global consciousness. Moreover, I think that, you know, just talking about global events and global spectacles and so on, there is a trend sweeping through the world where increasingly so-called emerging markets, emerging powers, are beginning to be hosts for events and spectacles that historically have been the preserve of the northern developed powers. So, you know, China's Olympic Games, you have the Commonwealth Games now on the agenda in India, and now South Africa's hosting of the World Cup. And I think that the assumption underlying all of this is this is a moment for the global South to present themselves to the world, to showcase themselves to the world. But actually, if you look at the global South, even today, I think it is differentiated. I mean, a powerful China is very different from a post-apartheid South Africa. And I think we need to put these things into perspective. And if you look at China, for example, I think the way they've done their games, it was in a framework of a development strategy. It was embedded in a kind of development path that they've been working on for a long time. And reforms that go back to the 70s and late 70s anyway. In the South African context, we've become almost consummate consumer of wanting to be in the spotlight. It's almost a sort of obsession. And, you know, in our context, we have very, very serious development challenges. The development gaps, the trends around inequality, the trends around poverty, I mean, all show that we are leaving behind large swathes of our population. And we are not getting certain things right. And if you are to consolidate a democracy in this day and age, and many of us want our country to work, these are the issues rather than the kind of soft projection issues of us being a happy nation, and particularly for just a moment of, you know, a month. So I think there's those two set of issues that I think need to be brought into the discussion when thinking about countries of the South hosting these events.
What is this obsession about being at the center?
I think it's got to do with the fact that, you know, we did avoid a kind of collapse, the barbarism in our transition. I think that we were able to negotiate a very, very difficult context. And, you know, the racialized society that we come out of could have taken us into a horrific end. And but I think, you know, that narrative, I mean, just going beyond that and showing the world that there was another way, coinciding with the sort of post-Cold War context, was also very, very important. It showed that, you know, we could use dialogue as a means to solve problems in the world, in a dynamically changing world, and that we could kind of engender a sort of democratic development trajectories or paths. However, I mean, I think, you know, we've used that kind of breakthrough in our diplomatic engagements with Africa. You know, we present ourselves as a success story in terms of democratic transition. We present that story to the rest of the world. That's given us currency at a host of levels within world politics. But I think that South Africa needs to be the miracle now in terms of consolidating that democracy, in terms of really giving it a future. I think there are a host of big questions around where we take our country.
Mm-hmm. Maybe I'm the dumb, numb consumer here because I love this show. Mm-hmm. I love the soccer itself. I love this whole metaphor of very, very particular national, competitive, urgent differences inside this kind of universal human game. I'm thrilled that it's in South Africa, which does sort of certify a step toward the center of the world stage. I happen to see these Cup of Nations games in Africa in January, and you can't miss the kind of rallying around, yes, a game, but such a human one. Kick my narrative around, because I think that is the one that's sort of floating in our maybe pseudo-innocent heads.
You know, Pelé has called it the beautiful game, and I don't know if you've had a chance to look at Galeano's book in Sun and Shadow, and he actually very beautifully portrays the history of the World Cup through those who've played the game, coming out of slums, coming out of barrios, and saying that this is and historically has been a people's sport. And
but I've also seen, you know, Bishop Tutu's comments that for all the corruption or the self-dealing or the corporate contracting that put those games in South Africa, it's still well worth the price, he says. And will do a world of good for South Africa's sense of itself.
Well, let's look at that squarely.
I'm eager to have you kind of raise our own doubts about this.
See, we are not against football or soccer, depending on whatever it is. I mean, I think that we must appreciate our starting point is we're not against those who love football. But I think what's important to recognize is that there are a few things. One, how this bid was clinched and the kind of bargain that was secured with FIFA. First, FIFA has ensured that it has a monopoly over ticket sales in this World Cup. Secondly, it has ensured that in terms of franchising inside this World Cup, whether it's McDonald's or whether it's any other corporate for that matter.
The official World Cup hamburger or whatever.
Exactly, yeah. Exactly. It's suggested that they have to put in at least a minimum of $120 million to get into the franchising pool. And of course, it's exclusive rights within the FIFA zone and space, which then has other implications, which I'll come to. The third is you have within the kind of FIFA approach, the media monopoly, a lot of the money is made around the media contracts for the World Cup. And again, they've sewn that up. It's in the bag for them. And it runs into billions of dollars. And also, there's a lot of opaqueness around all of this. And so numbers and figures, etc., are difficult. I think the fourth thing, though, is how it's literally constructed a sort of sovereign within the sovereign, a territorial zone within our democratic country in which our constitution is suspended. You cannot have any protests or expressions of freedom within the FIFA zone.
Maybe you'd give us a short course on FIFA. I wonder myself, first of all, who are they? I know they must be a huge global sort of Visa card corporation. Who knows where Visa is or who gets the money? I must say, on the other hand, sometimes I wonder maybe should FIFA rule the world? Isn't it the real United Nations? Don't they have more executive authority than almost any organization we could imagine?
We live in a very populist world if FIFA were to rule the world.
What if we had a peacekeeping organization as effective as FIFA is in soccer?
I wouldn't exaggerate its role. I just think that we got to understand the political economy of soccer. And
start from the beginning about FIFA, because...
Well, I mean, it's the international sort of body for global soccer. It sets the standards, the norms, the rules. It also is a global corporation. And it has the sole rights, the monopoly rights, to host this prestigious global event. And in that process, I mean, it's become a wealthy corporation.
And powerful and monolithic unquestioned.
Yeah.
What's good, what's bad about this?
Well, it's what it means for countries that want to host this prestigious and important global event. It means that you go to bargain with this monopoly. Mm-hmm. And, for developing countries, it's an uphill battle. And as I was pointing out to you, everything in the South African bid is stacked against South Africa. The flip side of this has been the soft arguments. Well, this will add to social cohesion, which sort of resonates with Archbishop Desmond Tutu, Nelson Mandela, and a host of other people. But in the context that we are in which inequalities have been widening, and all the data shows this, in which unemployment is actually going to the roof, we have conservatively a 26% unemployment rate and growing. And this has been a stubborn reality in our context. We've had what economists characterize as jobless growth. So, you have deep, deep discontent. So I don't know how you could marry the euphoria of the World Cup in a sustainable way with the future of our democracy. So that's kind of one side of things. The other side of things are the consequences of the FIFA bid for our country. And if I can lay it bare.
Please.
I mean, I think the first important issue is the democratic deficit in all of this. I've mentioned that FIFA has literally an impervious zone, a sovereign zone, in which our constitution is suspended. There are a few things around this. There are many, many social protests that have been going on in South Africa before the World Cup. What I call service delivery protests, mainly in township communities, who want delivery from the state, who want the promise that the state has held out to them to be realized. These struggles have been intensifying. During the World Cup, various organizations, and I'm part of a group of social movements and independent progressive individuals and so on, and communities who want to use the World Cup as a platform to give voice to these concerns so that the world sees the totality of the South African picture. Initially, the response from the state was all social protest action was banned. And the justification for that was, this is the FIFA World Cup and these are the rules and this is how we have to do it. This did not deter or stop civil society, progressive civil society. There have been engagements with lawyers sitting at the table with the state and literally arguments being made in defense of our civil liberties and our rights to protest action. That has led to a point where we were able to have now three important marches during the World Cup. There was permission given to a campaign around quality of education. There was permission eventually given to a Treatment Action Campaign march. The Treatment Action Campaign is a very globally renowned social movement that takes up issues around HIV/AIDS and antiretroviral drugs and so on. And they had a march planned, and that was also stopped, but they also forced the hand of the state and eventually secured permission. the movements I'm involved with, the Anti-Privatization Forum, the Soweto Electricity Crisis Committee, and a host of other community organizations, eventually clinched permission to march on Friday. Now, this action is rolling. On June 16th, in the city of Durban, the Durban Social Forum, made up of social movements, has planned a protest action. And they had a lot of difficulties also securing permission. And this was to the city hall, which is pretty far from the stadium. So anyway, so the one deficit is the democracy deficit. The other consequence of the World Cup has been macroeconomic. We clearly have a serious balance of payments problem. Some economists estimated at $80 billion. And largely got to do with the sort of pull of imports that went into constructing stadiums and so on. We are increasingly facing a fiscal crisis in local government. Now, again, the figures around the World Cup are very opaque. One of our national newspapers has just gone to the courts during the week to actually ask for government to be transparent on the total cost of stadiums. And it would seem that the cost is way, way higher than anybody has expected. Some put it above $43 billion or more. I think many of us are waiting anxiously for these figures to be put out in the public arena. The estimates suggest $43
billion. $43 billion, 10 rands to the dollar, might be something like $5 billion.
Yeah, something like that, yeah. So a lot of local governments were locked into this process and spending on these stadiums and ensuring their completion. And as a result, many local governments have a serious deficit. They have fiscal problems. Johannesburg is one classic example. It's operating on overdraft. There's a serious crisis waiting to happen post this World Cup, which is going to hit us very, very hard. I think the other important issue here is the fact that FIFA has very consciously ensured that street traders and those who make their livelihoods in these vicinities, around these stadiums and so on, they are policed. So you actually have a whole swarm of FIFA lawyers, for example, who have been swooping down on people selling little trinkets and selling little paraphernalia, etc., that might have FIFA kind of emblems on them, logos, or the World Cup icon, Zakumi on it, etc. And basically, it's all about policing patents and monopoly over patents.
Right.
And these very poor people are being herded into courtrooms and being squeezed in terms of intellectual property rights and so on.
So there's a democracy deficit. There's a big fiscal price to these stadiums. And there's this kind of mean monopoly enforcement. I'm sure there are worse things, too, even to talk about. Can I just say, I've seen, and I wish ABC was running Craig Tanner's movie, just critiquing the whole premise.
This movie is not allowed to be screened on national television.
In South Africa?
And yes, it's prohibited. And, and I would argue essentially banned from our national airwaves. So, you know, you have a documentary that's very balanced, that has both sides on it, giving both sides of the argument. And at the same time, raising all the big questions implicated in this. And we cannot use this as a national resource for a national conversation.
It makes a number of important points, including the profiteering and the maybe unnecessary stadiums. The unmistakable fact that the money around this World Cup will leave the country. But furthermore, that in the background, South Africa has all manner of untended social crises, including a falling life expectancy, 49.3, behind Ethiopia, behind Uganda, behind Burundi, behind Sudan. I mean, there are a lot of serious questions here. But let me ask, how might it have been different?
Well, I think there are different options. I mean, you know, one would have been to ensure that FIFA doesn't come out of this hailing it as the most commercially successful World Cup in the history of the game, which they have officially declared. They're going back with bags of money. They are not subjected to exchange controls. They are not subjected to tax. It's basically a free ride for FIFA. I mean, I think that we could have negotiated a different deal. That would have been one way to do this. with FIFA and the world of football. But unfortunately, you have this asymmetry. You have this prestigious game which is monopolized by one organization, and people in the world love this game and they know it and they exploit that. Brazil is hosting the next World Cup, and I think the lessons from our experience would be informative. I think it's important, A, to have proper legal arrangements in place that stipulate the kind of benefits for the country. FIFA needs to account. Sepp Blatter is on record as saying, well, you know, we're bringing this event to Africa. It's important to host it in Africa. And you know, it's all about the prestige now of Africa. It's Africa's moment. But what is the tangible legacy for Africa? What is being left behind? Mm. He's going to take back, with all his cronies, billions of rands and back to Switzerland. And so, you know, where does that leave us? I think, you know, it raises a challenge of how do we democratize FIFA? How do we negotiate the next World Cups? And I'm sure it's going to continue going on for a very long time, in a way that really benefits national development in countries.
Somebody in South Africa decided that let the money go, we will have the world's attention for a month. Mm. And that in some fashion, maybe even in dollars down the road, but in the meantime, in psychic benefits, is worth the price.
There's been a closing of the ranks. You know, this is a crucial moment for South Africa in more ways than one. And so people have just put their political weight behind it and legitimized it, which I think is not necessarily the best thing, because you cannot uncouple the World Cup from the bigger developmental challenges we face. And I think those who have stood up now to embrace this World Cup as the best thing for our country, I think they have a case to answer after this World Cup when the protest actions intensify. Because, you know, this World Cup has been done, and technically and in terms of construction, in sort of record time. There was a grand display of engineering capability and technology and so on. And, you know, people in South Africa's squatter settlements and in what we could call our slums, I am sure are wondering, you know, if they could do all this grandiose stuff, why haven't they built us houses over 15, 16 years of democracy? So I think these contradictions are going to come back to haunt the political forces that have stood by this.
If I were walking down the street with you in Johannesburg, what would people be saying about all this? Regular folk, not on television.
I think you'll get mixed responses and reactions. I mean, there's a general euphoric feeling sweeping through the nation. You know, the build-up to the World Cup has been a communications extravaganza, you know, and the state has played its part in drumming up support and whipping up the nation and so on. So, you know, there's a frenzied euphoria around the World Cup. And of course, many people are excited that it's happening in the country and so on. So you would definitely get positive responses, people being happy and excited about this. But again, for many of us, connecting up the dots and what happens after this World Cup would put some of us in the camp of the critique, the concerned, the worried.
Well, I'm always in that camp. Vishwa Sadkar, I just wonder, finally, what do you want to say about this generalized myth of the multi-culti magic of global sports, in which peace and competitive games, kids' games, prevail, even for a month now, against all the troubles of politics?
If I had to choose between war and football, I'll choose football.
Of course. But, I mean, do we believe this? I mean, it's elevated now to songs and Shakira's anthem, this time for Africa. And we all feel good about it. Do you want to kick those tires before we buy it?
I mean, I think it says something for global consciousness and the fact that, you know, we could have rivalries which are very real in the sort of global political economy. Again, put at abeyance, and, you know, we can have global cheer and sort of global euphoria. And, you know, we could have talking points wherever we are and wherever we live on this planet about our teams, about our country's performances and so on. But again, you know, it's a distraction from the real structural issues. Africa doesn't need a World Cup, I mean, in the context of the global crisis. Africa is feeling very hard the secondary impacts of the global economic crisis coming from the heartlands, economic heartlands. And I would argue that Africa really, really needs right now a serious economic program that can address what increasingly is, and every economist, every development economist is saying this, whatever's happened over the past three decades in the world has passed Africa by. The World Cup is not going to put us onto some kind of bandwagon and all else is going to be fine. It's not the silver bullet. It's not the magic wand.
Of course not. There are no such things.
Yeah.
On the other hand, can I just say, I watched those games, and the magic of it for me is that at the end of an hour, well, at the end of 2 hours watching Serbia and Ghana, I feel I'm Serbian. I feel I'm Ghanaian. I feel I've lived there all my life. I feel I know all those players, and I'm somehow better acquainted with the varieties of the world.
I think it does. It has a, if you were to call it this, an educative or a pedagogic effect, where we're forced to learn about others. But the irony of it all is that many of these world-class players, in the end, end up playing football in the most commercially developed sports centers, so mainly in Europe and so on. And a lot of them, in the end, are not really nationally based. They gather into their national teams and they sport their national colors because this is what FIFA wants and this is how the game is played. But generally, you know, national loyalties. There's an interesting player in South Africa called Benny McCarthy, and he plays for a British team. And there was a whole debate about him. He actually didn't pitch for many of the Africa Cup games over the past few years, primarily because of his loyalty to his British team. Suddenly, you know, Benny has to come home. Benny, please come home. You know, that was the refrain, you know. And of course, Benny McCarthy comes and suddenly he's a national hero, etc., etc. But anyway, that gives you a taste of exactly what this means. You know, I think there's a whole host of other stories within this. And people who follow football would know, well, okay, you know, so-and-so is playing for Germany today, but tomorrow they're in the European League, you know, and so on and so on. So it's, I think it's complicated.
In an ideal world, it lets you and I push for it. The games are just the start of a conversation, even like this one, about some of the other realities off the field. Thank you for raising our consciousness. And now back to the games.
Enjoy.
Paul McCarthy and Ben Mandelkern produced and edited this conversation. It isn't over till listeners add their two bits in comments on our website, radioopensource.org. I'm Christopher Lydon. Thank you for being part of the conversation.